Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000.
How will the ongoing coronavirus pandemic shape our summer in North Carolina? I'm Frank Stacio from WUNC. Today, public radio stations from across the state are coming together to look at how COVID-19 is changing our seasonal rituals like baseball and outdoor music festivals.
In each park, there is certainly sufficient space to be socially distanced by all attendees.
Reporters from the mountains to the coast share how their communities are adapting. We also talked to a coronavirus researcher who explains how to play it safe this summer.
Maybe don't have a giant family reunion, but have a picnic with some friends.
And we find out what the virus could mean for the Republican National Convention in Charlotte, scheduled for August.
I think that even before COVID, there was a lack of excitement about this.
Stay tuned for our Pandemic Summer, a statewide special, just ahead.
It's the unofficial start to summer. But aside from sweet strawberries and warmer days, there's not much that feels familiar this year. How will the ongoing coronavirus pandemic shape this season? Public radio stations from the mountains to the coast are collaborating today for Our Pandemic Summer, a statewide special. I'm Mike Collins, host of Charlotte Talks from WFAE.
I'm Frank Stacio, host of The State of Things on WUNC. Will there be minor league baseball games or indoor festivals? Reporters from Asheville and Winston-Salem take a look.
And I'm Anita Rao, a host for The State of Things. We'll also get the latest on the Republican National Convention slated for this August in Charlotte.
First, North Carolina is starting to reopen as researchers race to find a coronavirus vaccine. How close are they? And what can people do in the meantime to protect themselves? Frank talks to Lisa Grilinski, an assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She specializes in coronaviruses.
So you're spending long hours in the lab. You're working on treatments and a vaccine for the coronavirus. How is it going?
Absolutely. We're incredibly busy and working really long hours, but making some good progress. So we're encouraged.
Well, how do you know? I mean, what making progress where and how?
So we're seeing good results in cell culture models, looking at how the virus replicates in primary cells taken from human upper airways and lung cells, showing that some of these antiviral treatments are effective there. And then we've had really good luck in developing a mouse model, which is important to have an animal model to be able to test vaccines, therapeutics, monoclonal antibodies, all that type of thing.
So that makes me wonder if you have any kind of a timeline.
Ooh, timelines are very complicated because while we're seeing good initial results, we need to be able to put these vaccines into people, which has started, obviously, but then you want to be able to assess the immune response over time. So you want 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, and there's just no way to rush that.
Right. So if all went well now, if you took what you have right now and it stayed on the same trajectory and things kept going as well as they seem to be going now, again, can you give us a sort of a rough sense of what that might look like end of this year, middle of next year? And again, this would assume that everything goes just fine.
So I think it's possible that if everything goes fine, you know, as we're imagining in this scenario, which is hopeful and plausible, that, you know, a company or the government would be able to have an announcement that they have an effective vaccine before the end of this year, but then they have to actually be able to produce that vaccine and distribute it to people. So saying we found something that we think will work is very different from you or I being able to get a shot that then protects us from possible infection.
So the summer will pass without a vaccine, and I think we all knew that. But we're learning more about this virus every day. How does it respond to sunlight?
So that's a very complicated kind of up-in-the-air question. We know that UV rays are very effective in inactivating viruses of this type, but usually that's with more of a laboratory exposure, not something that would happen out in nature. Now, the government has made some announcements in early May saying that their group at the National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasure Center has shown that sunlight does have a really powerful effect on this virus, but we haven't seen any of that data actually released, and so it's hard to judge what kind of time they're talking about, what type of exposure is necessary. It's exciting news, and being able to think about going outside and maybe mix with people carefully at a distance is really encouraging, since people have been kind of trapped in their homes for several months now. But I'd like to see more data to feel confident about that.
Well, then what recommendations would you have for people who certainly do want to gather this summer with a few friends outside, or, you know, the beach, the lawn? What are your recommendations?
I think outside is absolutely the way to go. We've definitely seen that the virus transmits much more readily in confined indoor spaces. So the advent of good weather, and hopefully it doesn't get too hot and too humid too quickly, is really encouraging there. So I think outside, probably still wearing masks right now. I know that's what I'll be doing.
Safe distances?
Safe distances, absolutely. And keeping the numbers, you know, smallish. Maybe don't have a giant family reunion, but have a picnic with some friends.
I know, but that could lead to trouble because who gets left out? But that won't be your fault. We'll move on. And I want to ask you a question about pools and swimming holes, that kind of thing. What about them?
I know a lot of people are curious about that with summer coming up. And, you know, Durham just announced that they won't be opening their pools, which is probably a blow to some people. But I do understand their concerns about being safe and being able to, you know, hire lifeguards on time and everything. The actual act of being at a pool should be very safe. There's no evidence that the virus spreads through water, and especially a chlorinated or a salt pool should be fine. My concern is, again, the tight gatherings of people. You know, if kids are playing together in a pool, they're not going to be 6 feet away from each other.
Right.
You really maintain the appropriate distance.
Now, you have been working nonstop in the lab for months. Your husband has been staying at home, we understand.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any plans for a summer trip?
Not right now. Part of that is lab is incredibly busy, and being involved in kind of the vaccine responses and everything, we have a little bit of a higher responsibility to try and make sure that none of us get infected, because if we were, then the whole rest of the lab would be quarantined at home for 14 days as a close contact. And some of it is, you know, the numbers in North Carolina are still going up, unfortunately, and so wanting to be as safe as possible.
So what do you think is most important for people to keep in mind about the coronavirus as they make summer plans? Some people are going to want to travel. They're thinking about possibly hotels, bed and breakfast, that kind of thing. What should we be keeping in mind as we think about travel plans?
I would say driving, to me, makes a lot more sense than flying, unfortunately. I know the airline industry has been hit incredibly hard, but I can't see myself going to an airport or getting on a plane anytime soon. I think being able to be in control of your environment, avoiding really crowded indoor spaces is key. So maybe smaller facilities. Also, that's really helpful to be able to patronize mom and pop businesses. I think that will be important in keeping our economy going. And take the opportunity to enjoy the outdoors while you can.
Any thoughts about, I mean, hotels are sort of interesting. You can imagine they're taking extra precautions. On the other hand, they are enclosed indoor spaces with lots of people traveling through. Any thoughts on that?
You know, I don't have a lot of personal information about this, but I would want to see what they're doing to really control the public areas, the lobbies, anywhere people might congregate. The actual hotel room itself, I think, could probably be sanitized pretty effectively. So that I would feel more comfortable with than, you know, the lobby. Certainly a hotel, a pool or something could be a little bit worrisome just because so many people are there. And the concern is they've traveled from other spaces, and so you don't know what their history is.
All right, Lisa, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lisa Grilinski is a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at UNC Chapel Hill.
Baseball fans everywhere eagerly await news of whether Major League Baseball will start play this year. Once MLB makes up its mind, a decision on minor league baseball should soon follow. North Carolina is home to 11 minor league teams, including the Asheville Tourists of the South Atlantic League. Two of their fans feel the sting of life without baseball more than most. BPR's Megan Cain has their story.
The Bartlett residence is quiet. Too quiet.
There's just a void there.
Gary and Karen Bartlett are used to a packed house with a daily routine.
They would probably be sleeping till about 10 or 11, and then when they get up to eat breakfast, that's Gary's lunch. We visit a little bit and clean up, and they head to the ball field.
For the first time in 13 years, the Bartletts aren't following this routine. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, they never got to welcome three players from the Asheville Tourist baseball team into their home. The couple brings a group to live in their home rent-free every season. They're the only family that offers this to players in Asheville. Together, they attend nearly every game at McCormick Field. Karen sports a sparkly American flag cap and sits directly to the left of the dugout. When one of them isn't at a game, the players get concerned.
They know that we're going to be there night after night after night. If Karen's not with me, there'll usually be three or four guys come to the end of the dugout even before the game starts, wanting to know where Mama Karen is.
Without baseball, they have to find other ways to fill the void.
We have pictures on our refrigerator of all the boys, and we look at them and talk about the seasons, and we've talked to several of the boys.
When the tradition began, the Bartletts had no idea it would become such a big part of their lives.
I miss having them around and getting to know them and watching them play ball and hearing the crack of the bat and the smack of the ball in the glove and just the excitement of everything.
The excitement was paused in the middle of spring training. Asheville Tourist President Brian DeWine says the players were sent home before the roster was finalized.
When this all happened, we were about a month out from opening day, and we were going full steam ahead and basically came to a complete stop. We totally shut down our offices.
Regardless of the shutdown, DeWine says players receive daily workout plans digitally to stay in shape for when they get the long-awaited call for the season's start. McCormick Field remains silent for now. Whenever it can reopen, DeWine says they'll be ready to follow social distancing guidelines like credit card-only payments, limited crowd sizes, and ensuring six-foot distance between fans. Karen and Gary Bartlett are waiting patiently.
We call them our sons of summer. We tell them that we have met them because of baseball, but we love them because of who they are.
No matter when baseball returns, both say they'll be ready to welcome three new players into their lives. I'm Megan Cain, BPR News.
Coming up, we'll look at how the coronavirus pandemic is changing the lives of migrant farm workers in our state. You're listening to Our Pandemic Summer, a statewide special featuring reporting from public radio stations around North Carolina. Please stay tuned. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
You're listening to Our Pandemic Summer, a statewide special. Public radio stations from across North Carolina banded together to investigate how the coronavirus is changing the way we work and play this season. I'm Frank Stacio from WUNC. Four crops support more than 13,000 jobs in North Carolina, and all four require a lot of labor. Sweet potatoes, blueberries, peanuts, and tobacco are not easily harvested by machines. The bulk of that labor is provided through the H-2A program, which brings in workers from outside the country. But with produce fields facing a growing number of outbreaks, how will North Carolina's $87 billion industry adapt as the harvest season begins? Anita Rao from WUNC talks to News and Observer reporter Aaron Sanchez-Guerra to find out more.
So, Aaron, give us an overview of who makes up our seasonal farm labor workforce in North Carolina.
So the agricultural seasons in North Carolina, they're made possible by a seasonal immigrant farm worker workforce that are made up of mostly of workers who are authorized to come here in the United States temporarily by the U.S. Department of Labor. And they mostly come from Mexico. They're split up into the authorized guest workers and then also migrant farm workers, whom are typically undocumented and they live in the United States, have their families here and such, and they follow around different crops in the state and go to other states as well, and often share the workload with these authorized H-2A farm workers. They typically help growers catch up with the season if they if the H-2A authorized workers can't swing it in time for or according to the needs of the grower. And those workers can range from being Mexican to Guatemalan, Honduran, and Salvadoran. It gets pretty diverse.
So when we talk about farm labor in North Carolina, obviously we're relying on it for a lot of our crops, tobacco in the summer, sweet potatoes in the early fall, Christmas trees, and as you said, kind of made up primarily of these two groups, migrant workers that may travel state to state based on need, as well as H-2A workers contracted by the North Carolina Growers Association that come here each year. And North Carolina really relies on these H-2A workers for the state's economy. And you spoke with the deputy director of the North Carolina Growers Association about how vital this workforce is. I want to take a quick listen to that clip and then have you speak a bit more about H-2A workers. Let's listen to Lee Wicker.
This is not going to be the last pandemic that we're going to face. And we ought to be thinking about this in the bigger picture of, are we going to grow labor-intensive crops in this country or not? And are we just going to grow corn and soybeans and wheat and cotton and peanuts and highly mechanized, you know, big equipment commodities, and import all the labor-intensive crops from places that have a dramatically lower cost for their labor? Are we going to bring guest workers here and grow it here and support American workers' jobs and John Deere and Chevrolet and Ford and Case tractors and the Teamsters driving it up and down the road? And, you know, like, every guest worker that comes here is supporting like 2.5 or 3 American workers' jobs.
So that was Lee Wicker, the deputy director of the North Carolina Growers Association. I'm talking to News and Observer reporter Aaron Sanchez-Guerra. So as he's saying, H-2A workers are really vital because these are really labor-intensive crops. So we come to this then moment now. We are in the summer. More workers are coming here to work on these seasonal crops, and we are having this coronavirus pandemic. So tell me what we know so far about outbreaks among farm workers in North Carolina.
The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, as part of their reporting of outbreaks in congregate living facilities like nursing homes and correctional facilities, they've reported there's been 49 coronavirus cases across 5 agricultural farms. 4 of these, they focus primarily on produce like strawberries. They're pick-your-own farms. And the cases are split between farm staff and also the seasonal farm workers who are employed by the farm and also live in grower housing.
So as we've been hearing a lot about various food processing facilities and parts of our food system around North Carolina, we've learned a lot about the conditions in these specific places that really put workers at risk, as well as other conditions about the industry itself. I'd love for you to explain, when it comes to farm workers in particular, what is it about farm labor that really puts workers at risk for contracting COVID-19?
The reality for the seasonal H-2A farm workers is that they are virtually always around each other. If they're not with at least one other worker in their living quarters, they're with whole groups of them out on the fields, sitting down for lunch, going to the grocery store to get food for the week, or in the kitchen cooking together. They live in dormitory-style housing. What I mean by that is that they often share an old house, barracks, trailers, and they sleep near each other. They travel in repurposed school buses to and from work. And if one worker gets sick, it can threaten a whole camp, which has already been happening across a few of these farm worker camps in North Carolina.
You've been speaking with a couple of workers, and you spoke with one, Javier Hernandez, who's an H-2A worker in Harnett County working on sweet potato and tobacco. Tell me a bit about what he shared with you, and then we're going to listen to a clip of him speaking in Spanish.
So Javier Hernandez, who is from San Luis Potosí, the state of San Luis Potosí in Mexico, I had checked in with him back in March, sort of seeing, are you sure you're going to come this year during the pandemic? And he's like, yeah, I am. And I'm like, hey, what do you think you'll do? You know, what have you been hearing? And, you know, he kind of just told me what he knew back then. So I followed up with him recently, and, you know, he told me that his camp has been instructed to not leave their living quarters, to go out to the store or anything like that. Travel is restricted. They've been given masks for when they do go out.
Let's listen to a clip.
cada quien está en su cuarto, ¿verdad? Casi nadie sale. Y sí, de hecho nos prohibieron de salir. Por ejemplo, los días que luego los domingos uno se iba pues a las pubes, ¿verdad? Y ahorita ya no, nada de eso de salir para evitar algún contagio o algo así.
That's Javier Hernandez, an H-2A worker in Harnett County. You have documented a little bit in terms of what we know about confirmed cases. Tell me about testing and protection for these workers. What kind of testing is going on and who is looking out to track and protect them from further outbreak?
The growers that I spoke to, from what they were willing to tell me, they, as soon as they identified that a worker had symptoms, they saw to it that worker got tested, and then all these other positive cases would come out. Signifying that it's in the best interest of the health of the farm staff and farm workers for whole farms to get tested, just to be safe. In one case in a farm in Wake County, a strawberry farm, the farm worker health outreach organization, North Carolina Farm Workers Project, they were contacted by a worker who was complaining of symptoms at a Wake County farm. Then they contacted the grower. Grower cooperated with them, did a back and forth, coordinated testing for farm staff and for the farm workers. Turns out 14 of the farm workers were sick, had to get quarantined, and that definitely affected operations at the farm. And the grower was very, very concerned. Some of the workers have already recovered as of 2 weeks ago. And it's a big concern, but it's unknown if every single farm in North Carolina that employs these three workers is doing the testing.
And how much has the state or federal government responded in terms of oversight and really tracking to make sure that these workers are staying safe?
North Carolina Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler told me in early May that these workers were our lifeblood, he said. And they said they were working with the Department of Labor and the North Carolina Growers Association to really take care of these workers, make sure that they're safe. They're taking a range of measures. And the North Carolina DHHS was doing their part by reporting the number of cases per affected farms. But as of last Friday afternoon, they actually removed the names of the affected farms as they were reporting before and just replaced it with the names of the roads that the farms are located on. Of course, I asked them why they did that. Their reasoning was that the outbreaks often happen in workers who live in housing that are not directly on the farm property, probably a couple roads away, maybe a mile or so away. And so they wanted to be more accurate with that. And they also told me that COVID-19 is not a foodborne illness. That was also what two growers told me. You know, they stressed that customers and the general public did not need to worry about, you know, infected produce or anything like that. And but I think that they have effectively made it more difficult for customers and journalists alike to identify these affected farms by just putting vaguely a road name with no identifying numbers or anything, and just the county in which the outbreak happened. So moving on, while this may be helping farmers and their business, it's making a little bit harder for it to be transparent exactly where these outbreaks are happening or which farms these affected farm workers work for.
And I don't have much time, but I would like to end just quickly talking about the memorandum of understanding signed last week that would allow the Defense Production Act to be invoked to protect the supply chain for farmed produce. So this is something that we know happened with meat processors to keep them from closing after their facilities had outbreaks. What kind of ramifications are there if farms were required to stay open during an outbreak?
Well, if farms are required to stay open during an outbreak, that's going to ensure that these very, very important supply chains, as Lee Wicker of the North Carolina Growers Association in the audio, as he said, it's going to prevent this ripple effect, economic ripple effect, that from occurring. It's going to be good for workers who want to continue working and don't want anything to get in the way of that. But for farms that are seeing outbreaks, it, like meat and poultry processing facilities that are seeing outbreaks, it poses a great risk to inhibiting the workflow that is needed to meet the demand that there needs to be. North Carolina is the number one producer in the country for sweet potato and tobacco, and I believe the number two producer for Christmas tree production. And there's a lot of demand that needs to be met, and farm workers and growers alike, they will really have to hustle to protect themselves from COVID-19 if they're to meet this very large demand that is very expensive to meet by bringing in these tens of thousands of workers from outside of the United States.
Aaron Sanchez-Guerra is a reporter for The News and Observer. Aaron, thank you so much.
Thanks, Anita.
At this time last year, music venues and arts organizations all across the state were busy marketing their summer concerts and festivals to an eager public. Spring of 2020 finds those same organizations trying to find their way forward in the new coronavirus landscape. As WFDD's David Ford reports, their approaches have been as varied as the venues themselves.
The Triad Park Amphitheater sits in an enormous open field surrounded by nature, and it's buzzing. Hundreds of people converse on lawn chairs and blankets, laughing and dancing as the sun begins to set. This is the city's Summer Parks Concert Series. Arts Council CEO Randy Eady says back in March, the prospect of shutting it all down due to COVID-19 was tough.
We know how impactful the concerts have been in the past, and we were excited about what they could be this year. And so our decision was to proceed with the planning, knowing that it was uncertain if we would be able to actually stage the concerts.
Eady says he's guardedly optimistic that the county will give the green light, particularly since this festival takes place outdoors.
In each park, both Triad Park and Tanglewood Park, there is certainly sufficient space to be socially distanced by all attendees.
Eady says planning new guidelines for food trucks, sponsor booths, and other accommodations is ongoing. But are people really ready for this? Answers are all over the map.
Well, I would be very cautious. I'm in the target group for this disease, as I guess we all are. But I am going to continue to avoid any crowds for the foreseeable future.
If it was just me, then maybe I would go. But I have a spouse that works at local hospital, and I have aging parents.
Music attendance and participation and performing are crucial to who we are. So outdoor concerts done the right way, we would go.
There's so much information that's still being uncovered about COVID-19, and it's virtually impossible to practice social distancing at a festival like that or an outside of event.
That was Skip Staples, Leslie Russell, Tim Blackburn, and Cheryl Harry. And so it's full steam ahead for Winston-Salem's Summer Parks Concert Series, but it's a hybrid approach at a Greensboro outdoor festival. Music for a Sunday evening in the park, MUSEP, fills the city's many beautiful green space venues with free live music for audiences to enjoy at dusk. Director Ryan Deal says back in March, nobody imagined what COVID-19 would mean for the 40-year-old concert series. He says they soon realized changes had to be made.
I mean, that becomes the first complicating factor relative to MUSEP, is that you can't really do a concert series if you don't have music groups that have the ability to rehearse.
So Deal is pushing back the first in-person performances to August to allow for rehearsal time and prepare for unknowns, like what will mass gathering limits be, with estimated crowds north of 1,000 people, which parks will be too tight, and more.
If we have an obligation to ensure social distancing is maintained, how can we manage through that? Is there any baseline amount of symptom screening that would need to take place if we were convening large groups of people?
It's been a challenge, Deal says. Thankfully, though, the artists are lined up and ready to go. But one area festival has had a completely changed course, the Eastern Music Festival. The 5-week classical music festival and summer education program on Guilford College's campus attracts distinguished faculty, renowned visiting artists, and hundreds of young musicians from around the world.
The original fear was protecting the students, the faculty, the audiences.
That's Media and Communications Director Kelly Swindell. In mid-April, after considering private lessons, rehearsals, and dorm life, she and her colleagues decided to cancel EMF for the first time in its 59-year history. The festival is offering online lessons and seminars this year, but still, she says, this has been hard.
It was a risk because it's a financial risk. It's a reputation concern. How do you stay relevant and engaged when you're only a five-week festival versus a year-round organization?
Swindell says right now things are going to be tight with a loss of tuition and ticket revenue. She says there will have to be more fundraising, especially because next year is a big one for EMF. If it's safe to do so, it plans on celebrating its 60th anniversary in style. For WFDD News, I'm David Ford.
Summer camps are a big part of the culture of Western North Carolina. The region is home to more than 70 camps of all types for kids of all ages. Many are still deciding if they'll close because of COVID-19. BPR's Lily Knepp explains the situation.
Singing songs around a campfire, canoeing, team building, these are all activities that are associated with summer camp. There are also activities that require close contact, something that isn't possible in the social distancing world of COVID-19.
You know, for us, Capture the Flag is probably one of the most popular things we do every Sunday.
That's director Ryan Hove from YMCA Camp Wataya near Bryson City.
And that's kind of the first big all-camp activity. You know, that seemed really unlikely that we were going to be able to, you know, facilitate stuff like that.
Despite other YMCA camps across the country remaining open, Hove and his team made the choice to close for the summer on May 15th. Many other camps in the region have been family-run for generations. Their experience extends to viruses, says Sandra Garcia-Boyer, executive director of the North Carolina Youth Camp Association.
Camps have a long, long history of planning and managing communicable diseases. So certainly through polio and most recently SARS, camps are uniquely ready for this type of situation.
Garcia-Boyer says about 20 camps in the association have already canceled, while others haven't made a decision. She stresses camps are a major industry in Western North Carolina. Over $360 million are associated with the camps just in her organization, according to a 2010 study.
I'm Adam Boyd, and I'm the camp director at Camp Merrimack for girls and Camp Timberlake for boys.
Girls-only Camp Merrimack opened in 1945 near Black Mountain. So far, both camps have canceled June sessions, but Boyd hopes they'll be able to open later in the summer. He's waiting to hear when North Carolina will move into Phase 3 to make a decision. North Carolina moved to Phase 2 on May 22nd, and that is expected to last at least 5 weeks. I'm Lily Knepp, BPR News.
Just ahead, will the coronavirus pandemic have a big impact on the Republican National Convention in Charlotte this August? WFAE's Mike Collins finds out. Please stay with us.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Our Pandemic Summer, a statewide special. I'm Anita Rao from WUNC. Public radio stations from around the state are coming together to examine how the coronavirus is changing our seasonal rituals. For several years now, Charlotte's biggest plans for summer 2020 revolved around hosting the Republican National Convention. The COVID-19 pandemic has raised concerns about the wisdom of those plans, but as we hear from WFAE's Mike Collins, this is nothing new.
Charlotte City Council, led by Mayor Vi Lyles, decided to make the pitch to host the 2020 convention, but almost immediately after being awarded this prize, some Democrats on the majority Democratic Council had objections based mainly in politics, but also concerns about how hosting the convention might impact the city's image. Once COVID-19 resulted in nationwide shutdowns, that provided new fuel to opponents who began citing health concerns. At-large Democratic Councilman Braxton Winston has been opposed since the very beginning, but particularly during this pandemic.
We need to stop this charade right now. We should not tell our city staff, our CMPD, to use our resources to plan for something that we know that it is not going to happen.
But Tariq Bakari, one of two Republicans on council, recently expressed frustration at ongoing opposition to a decision that was made long ago.
Instead of wasting time imagining what this city is going to look like in 4 months, when there's going to be dozens of stakeholders and experts and others that are going to help us make that decision, how about we spend this time focusing on what thousands of our small businesses in our own backyard are going through today, which is an unprecedented extinction event. I bet they'd prefer we'd be using our time in a different way.
WFAE's political reporter and host of the station's Inside Politics podcast, Steve Harrison, has been covering this issue since the very beginning. He joins me now. Steve, Charlotte was one of the few cities, some would say the only city, that tried to secure this convention. Wasn't most of council on board at the start?
So, right. If you go back to January 2018, at the time, 10 of the 11 council members told Mayor Vi Lyles to move forward with the bid, including Braxton Winston, who we heard from earlier. But as it came out, as the months went on and it came out that Charlotte was really the only municipality in the country to put in a bid, a lot of council members had second thoughts. Of course, everything in the age of Trump is controversial and they got cold feet.
So taking the politics out of this, I remember when the Democratic convention was coming, when it was on its way, there was a lot of buzz, a lot of excitement in the air. This time around, not so much. Is that because we've done this before, so it's old hat, or because we've been preoccupied with COVID-19, or is something else at work here?
I think that even before COVID, there was a lack of excitement about this. And part of that is this is a Democratic city. This is a Republican convention. But a big part of it is just that we did this 8 years ago, and Charlotte managed to pull it off. So the sequel is always less interesting than the original.
So Charlotte's Democratic Mayor Vi Lyles led the charge to secure the RNC and has been an ardent supporter all along. She's going to break with tradition and not appear at the convention, but she has said that the GOP is welcome because Charlotte is an inclusive city. And she also likes to point out that we have a legally binding contract. And she's been saying that even in the face of the pandemic until a recent appearance on MSNBC.
I know they want to have a convention. The Democrats in Milwaukee, we aren't any different than they are. When we talk about what we're going to do to keep people safe, we're going to have to follow the lead. And fortunately, now the Democrats are right before the Republican convention. I think that we will see something that will help us be better. But no matter what it is, no matter what, it has to be about keeping people safe. That means following the science. We've got vulnerable populations in Charlotte. We have people that have chronic diseases. We have our elderly. We need more testing. We need to trace people wherever they are. But we can't go into this with just, well, we've agreed to something in 2018 and we're going to continue to do it. That is not the world today.
Steve, that sounds like a complete reversal and a real change of tone to why.
I think a big part of that is she's speaking to a national audience on MSNBC. But the truth is that the city agreed to it in 2018, and they're going to have to go through with it. The only people who can stop the convention or curtail it is Governor Roy Cooper and Mandy Cohen, the Health and Human Services Secretary. The city is kind of powerless at this point.
The city is getting $50 million from the federal government to be used for security. And although there were some concerns about demonstrations at the RNC, our police chief is convinced that we can handle anything. But now there are concerns about 50,000 people coming to town at a time when social distancing will most likely be wise. So what are we hearing about those concerns?
Well, the Republican National Committee is acknowledging that this will be a different convention. They've said that, look, everyone inside the arena may be wearing masks. That's a possibility. They've said people could be standing 6 feet apart. So they've kind of taken the first steps in acknowledging that this is different. But there's so many other questions in terms of if you do have a lot of people here, how would the restaurants handle them? How would the hotels handle cleaning? That kind of thing. And I think maybe starting July 1st, if this looks like it's moving forward, then we'll have some answers and start trying to figure that out.
What are we hearing from Charlotteans, from citizens of Charlotte, about having 50,000 people from all over the country descend on them in one fell swoop?
So, you know, like we talked about earlier, that this is a Democratic city and this convention has been controversial from the start. And so COVID has really only intensified that. And so you just see a lot of comments, hear a lot of comments about people really worried and concerned about bringing so many people from around the world to the convention. Now, I do think that even if this goes off, there probably won't be 50,000 people. I think a lot of even media has started saying they're going to pull back and we'll only cover this, you know, in small amounts. There won't be the big parties and big, huge gatherings that you had before. But yeah, people are concerned.
I was going to ask, the restaurants and hotels have been closed for 9 weeks. Do they have enough time to gear back up, bring people back online in a massive amount to serve 50,000 people?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And like we've talked about that right now, restaurants can operate at 50% capacity, and that means having a minimal staff. That may not change until July 1st. So it's possible that you could have guests here at the RNC coming, and there's only a few restaurant tables for them because of social distancing and the state's rules, and there's really nowhere for people to go. So, yeah, I don't think we really know.
You spoke with the chair of the Republican National Committee, Ronald McDaniel, about making changes to their convention plans.
So I think by the end of June, we'll have a good feel, and we'll have to start making some critical decisions if we do have to make adjustments.
Then on Memorial Day, President Trump called the question. He tweeted, "I love the great state of North Carolina so much that I insisted on having the Republican National Convention in Charlotte at the end of August. Unfortunately, Democrat Governor Roy Cooper is still in shutdown mood and unable to guarantee that by August we will be allowed full attendance in the arena." And he then asked for an immediate answer from the governor about whether we can use the space, meaning the Republican National Convention, because he would be reluctantly forced to find, with all the jobs and economic development it brings, another Republican National Convention site. Is he politicizing this, Steve?
I think yes. I think he politicizes everything. The question is this a real threat? Can they move the convention? Is there another city that would want to have them? The next day after he made the tweet, the mayor of Jacksonville, Florida, said that city would want the convention. But I haven't heard anyone else raise their hand and say we'd like it.
Can you organize at this point for 50,000 people from ground zero?
I mean, I think 50,000 people would probably be really hard, but, you know, I think they probably could. I mean, because if you think about it, you know, the president, you know, he stages these big rallies pretty quickly on a few days' notice. So I don't think you could do a traditional convention in 3 months' time, but you could probably do some form, some kind of watered down version with 10,000 people or 15,000 people. That might work.
And what has been the governor's response to that tweet?
So Governor Cooper basically said, you know, kind of didn't really address the question specifically. He just said that the state will continue to, you know, look at the data and the metrics to protect the public health. So Trump and the Republicans are not going to get a firm commitment from the governor anytime soon.
And Charlotte City Council Republican Ed Driggs said this is just a dramatic gesture from a president known for making dramatic gestures. But Union County State Representative Mark Brody, a member of the Republican National Committee, has a different take. What did he say?
I think he said that he thinks the convention will move forward as planned. And I think he said that he thinks the virus will be past us by August, by the time of the convention. I maybe he meant August 2023. I'm not sure. But I don't think there's really many people saying that. Maybe that'll happen. But I don't think there's many experts who think that we'll be in the clear by that point.
Mayor Lyles has consistently said we have a contractual obligation to hold this convention. She's also said that health will trump the contract, but contracts go two ways. If they pull the convention, do we have recourse?
That's a good question. I mean, under normal circumstances, the city would have recourse. If they feel like they can't hold it because of the pandemic, then maybe not. And I think it's kind of a moot point because I just can't really see the city of Charlotte fighting to keep the convention here. I think they're going to say, okay, see you later.
Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter and host of WFAE's Inside Politics podcast.
Independent restaurant owners often start their businesses because they are chefs, artists whose medium is food and drink. As Governor Roy Cooper cautiously allows the state to move into phase two, they're going to need all their creativity just to keep their business going. WHQR's Rachel Lewis Hilburn reports.
Harper Peterson is a Democratic state senator from New Hanover County on North Carolina's southern coast.
You can include restaurateurs with artists living day to day with a vision and a passion, but also an economic legacy.
Restaurants drive tourism, and tourism drives the economy.
It creates jobs. It supports charities. It's part of the creative identity of our community.
Harper Peterson is also a restaurant owner, and he worries that at half capacity, a number of restaurants aren't going to make it.
It's estimated to be over 50% we won't see again in September.
I think nobody really had any inkling of like exactly how deep and wide the problem was going to be.
That's Chidi Kumar. She plays guitar in a rock band called Birds of Avalon. She's also the chef and co-owner of the downtown Raleigh restaurant Garland.
In our building, we also have a music venue called King's, which is upstairs, and Neptune's Parlor, which is a bar, which is in the basement.
Chidi Kumar is also a three-time semifinalist for the James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Southeast. This third time, the ceremony is planned for September in Chicago.
Maybe it'll be outside. Maybe it's wishful thinking. I really hope it's not a Zoom call.
But September is a long way off, especially when she's thinking every day about ways to keep her business afloat without endangering customers or employees. Wake County was first in North Carolina to confirm a case of COVID-19, and it suffered the third highest number of deaths in the state. So for Chidi, the threat is real. She's also not eager to open too soon because she doesn't want to see a resurgence.
You know, when you look at other countries, they relax and they have a relapse, and it's just going to be a while.
However long that while turns out to be, Billy Mellon is looking forward to celebrating the 10th anniversary of his Wilmington restaurant, Manna, in November. As he thinks about reopening, he says he'll treat it like the opening of a new restaurant with simplified menus, expansion of the dining area into the bar next door, and training employees on new protocols. He's also going to focus on romance.
The days of calling your friend you haven't seen in a year or 6 months to come have like a party of six are going to be behind you for a while, at least not going to happen for a while. So I think it's going to be husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, and we're going to prepare ourselves to be like every day is Valentine's Day, which is not bad. A lot of love.
One of the surprising upsides of the pandemic for Billy Mellon, time.
Like I reinvented this wine club that I've been thinking about for a while, but I just never had the time to slow down and like dial it in logistically.
Dean Neff, also a James Beard nominated chef, is working on the opening of his new restaurant, Seabird, in downtown Wilmington.
Initially, we were thinking June, July, and now we're thinking September, October is probably the more realistic date of opening.
Ed Wolverton is executive director of Wilmington Downtown, Inc. He says cities around the state are looking at allowing restaurants to expand outdoors. In downtown Wilmington, that could look a lot like parking day.
That is an international thing that reimagines how public space can be used by taking a parking space and turning it into a temporary park for just one day.
But it's complicated. There are state statutes regulating alcohol consumption outside, and municipalities would need to clearly define how they want al fresco dining to look.
When you look at places like Bourbon Street and Beale Street in Memphis, and they are pretty wild party places. I think the community has to have a soul searching of, is that what we're talking about? And I think some people are talking about that. I'm not sure that everyone has that same vision in mind.
Neff, Mellon, and Kumar are experimenting with meals that customers can pick up and finish at home. Industry recommendations for the so-called new normal include going to single-use menus, single-use condiments, unless those salt and pepper shakers or ketchup bottles are cleaned after each diner. Dean Neff sees masks in the restaurant for customers and workers.
We've talked about having, you know, specific people on staff that all they do is take dirty plates away. We have people that are designed to just bring clean plates to the table, and they're washing in between every procedure and wearing gloves at the table. We've even thought of having bags for guests to put their PPE in the bag while they eat. That's a clean bag.
The pandemic has also exposed the cracks in this country's food production system, says Chidi Kumar, as unpurchased produce rots in farmers' fields.
I mean, how broken of a system can that be? Right now, I think everybody is realizing that they may not be able to find stuff in the big grocery store, but they can go to the market and get something that's even better for them, and it's fresh and it's grown within 100 miles, maybe.
Senator Harper Peterson has sponsored a bill called Save Our Authentic Restaurants Act and Hotel Stabilization Fund. It would offer loans of up to $50,000 and would reward restaurants for buying from local farmers and fisheries.
A lot of small and medium-sized farmers, they're also hanging by a thread. So if you buy from them, and we can document that money will be forgiven.
As a restaurant owner himself, Peterson says he will take nothing from this program as it's an obvious conflict of interest. For Chidi Kumar, the pandemic and its challenges have connected her more deeply to her community. And while she's worried a lot and she hasn't played as much music as she would like, she's nurtured friendships with fellow restaurateurs and chefs.
Just knowing that we're not alone and like operating that way and taking the time to be present with each other, that's been pretty remarkable.
For WHQR, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn in Wilmington.
Our Pandemic Summer, a statewide special, was produced in Durham at the studios of WUNC with help from WFAE in Charlotte, WFDD in Winston-Salem, WHQR in Wilmington, and Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Thanks so much for listening and stay safe this summer.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.